This evening we're continuing our series on idols, and this evening the idol of so-called success. Colossians, the third chapter, verse 23, is our primary verse that we'll look at here in a few minutes. But I would venture to say that the biggest idol in our culture and our cultural worship center is this idol of success. And this includes having money. It also includes getting our name recognized. One of the things, you go to a ball game with a big group and you're waiting to get your name recognized on the board or wherever it is sometimes. But if someone can do something that makes them rich or lands them in the tabloids or on a consistent basis, so that we as a culture are so impressed. You know, worse than that, we're sometimes obsessed. We want to know all the details, for instance, of certain people's lives. It used to be Tom and Nicole, and then was Brad and Jennifer, and then it was Brad and Angelina, and on it goes. You know, we're the same way about athletes. The media loves to talk about how much money they make and about their exploits off the field, and even things that have nothing to do with the sports. And so we as a nation are just fascinated with celebrities because, as a nation, we tend to idolize success. And it happens in the church too. You know, when Rick Warren and Bill Hybels started the seeker-sensitive churches at roughly the same time in the early 80s, they were blasted by colleagues and others in the religious community. A dozen or so years later, when their churches suddenly become two of the largest churches in the country, thousands of other churches decided it was time to become seeker-sensitive and have contemporary services. If it hadn't worked so well with Hybels and Warren, most churches would never have employed any change in strategy at all. But when something becomes successful, we want in on it, don't we? Americans love success, no question about it. We idolize it, and because we idolize success, we tend to idolize work. When an individual gives him or herself completely to their career and working 16 hours a day to the exclusion of everything else, we're not likely to say that's an obsession or that's an addiction. We're most likely to say that's dedication. Well, when it comes to talking about work and career, Americans seem to swing between two extremes. You know, on one side, we worship our career, we obsess about our work, we define ourselves completely by what we do and how much we make. And on the other side, there are many who hate their jobs, they hate showing up for work each day, who wish they could do anything in the world other than what they're doing right now. And then there are those who fall into both categories. They hate their jobs, but they keep giving themselves to it, body and soul, every day. The problem with career worship is that it is an unhealthy approach to your job and your career. The Bible indicates that there are four problems that we can see with this kind of worship. The first is, it causes you to work for that which you can't keep. It causes you to work for that which you can't keep. In other words, you can't take it with you. You know, and since you can't take it with you, you leave it behind for somebody else. Solomon didn't like that idea either, and not at all. And we've been looking at Ecclesiastes a lot in this. Ecclesiastes 2:18 and 19, he says, I am disgusted that I must leave the fruits of my hard work to others. And who can tell whether my successors will be wise or foolish? And yet they will control everything I have gained by my skill and hard work. How meaningless. USA Today reported last year about how many wealthy Americans, or about two of the wealthy Americans, one was Bill Gates and one was Warren Buffett, had decided not to leave the bulk of their wealth to their children. And I guess they had read one too many Paris Hilton headlines, or they'd seen what a big inheritance can do to kids. I don't think any of us have enough money to put our heirs at the risk of turning into the Hilton sisters. But we can relate to the idea that everything that we work for will be left behind. to be used at the discretion of others. And this is a fact of life. So if all you work for in this life is money, if all you leave behind is money, then you've given your life to something that you can't keep. Now, another problem with career worship is that it ruins relationships. It ruins relationships. It's not conducive to a strong marriage or to a strong family life. When you put your career first, everything else gets moved on down in the priority list. Anniversaries, birthdays, ball games, dance recitals, all are missed. And the family gets used to doing things without you there. And you get used to spending the majority of your time with strangers. And it leads to loneliness. And Solomon said it this way in Ecclesiastes 4:8. He says, "This is the case of a man who is all alone without child or brother, yet who works hard to gain as much wealth as he can. But then he asks himself, who am I working for? Why am I giving up so much pleasure now? It is all so meaningless and depressing." Don Henley's song, "The Heart of the Matter," contains a line that every working spouse should remember. The song is about a failed relationship. And he says, "Pride and self-assurance cannot fill these empty arms. And the work between us, it doesn't keep me warm. I'm learning to live without you now." A career first mentality ruins relationships. Now, a third thing is it leads to an inaccurate perception of success. It leads to an inaccurate perception of success. C.S. Lewis said, "Prosperity knits a man to the world. He feels that he is finding his place in it while it is really finding its place in him." This is similar to what Ray Romano discovered during the successful run of his TV program, Everybody Loves Raymond. He had become one of the highest paid actors on television, but he knew it wasn't enough. And when the show went off the air after 9 successful seasons, Ray shared his heart with the audience on the last day that they did the filming. He read them a note his brothers had stuck in his luggage the day that he moved from New York out to Hollywood. "My older brother Richard wrote, 'What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul?' Romano said, and he said it through tears. So now I'm going to work on my soul." And of course, his brother was referring to something that Jesus had said in Matthew 16:26. "How do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul in the process? Is anything worth more than your soul?" And of course, Solomon must have felt this way because he said in Ecclesiastes 2:11, "But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless. It was like chasing the wind." Another problem with the career-first way of thinking is that it tends to make you smug. It tends to make you smug. It fosters an illusion of self-reliance. It leads to arrogance. It causes you to think that you are all that you need. You know, Jesus told the story of a rich man in the Gospel. Luke said this: "A rich man had a fertile farm that produced fine crops. In fact, his barns were full and overflowing. So he said, 'I know, I'll tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And then I'll have room enough to store everything. And I'll sit back and say to myself, my friend, you have enough stored away for years to come. Now take it easy. Eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, you will die this very night. Then who will get it all? Yes, a person is a fool to store up earthly wealth but not have a rich relationship with God.'" This man thought he had everything, that he had all that he needed, but his priorities were wrong. And he had overlooked that which was most important, his spiritual life. It reminds me of something that Jim Carrey once said. He says, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not really the answer. So we looked at it. So let's look on how to destroy this idol. Now there's nothing wrong with success. There's nothing wrong with being well paid. There's nothing wrong with loving your job. In fact, all these things are gifts from God. Solomon, Ecclesiastes 2:24 says, So I decided there is nothing better than to enjoy food and drink and to find satisfaction in work. Then I realized that this pleasure is from the hand of God. On the one hand, Solomon says that work is meaningless. On the other hand, he says that work is a gift from God. So what is the difference here? The difference is in what comes first. Now, it's a matter of priorities. When work and pay and recognition and status become your top priorities, your career deteriorates into idol worship. And this leads to greed, and then it leads to frustration, and then it leads to disappointment, and ultimately it leads to isolation. So then how do you destroy this idol? You destroy it through first mastering the spiritual power of missional living. And that means living with a mission. It means living to serve others. And for this reason, we must learn to redefine success. Success is not determined by wealth or position. It's determined by what you accomplish for the long-term benefit of others. Here's how John Maxwell defines success. He says, success is choosing to enter the arena of action determined to give yourself to the cause that will better humanity and last for eternity. He's saying that success is determined by what you accomplish for the long-term benefit of others. When you define success this way, you see that it is sinful not to pursue success. You destroy the idol of career worship by developing a sense of mission about your life. And your mission is defined according to how it benefits others, not how it benefits you. So how do we develop this missional mindset? And this evening I want to mention three things that you can do to develop a missional mindset. First of all, view your job in terms of who you serve. View your job in terms of who you serve. Many jobs are actually built around the idea of helping others. You know, it's usually about serving the customer in one way or another, whether you're a paying customer or not. In your job, take some time to think about who you are called to serve. Maybe it's a customer, and maybe it's coworkers, and maybe it's the boss. But think about it. Take some time to answer the question, for whose benefit am I here? I can guarantee one thing, the answer will never be, I'm here for my benefit. No, Jesus said, the greatest among you must be a servant. Matthew 23:11. Your job is to serve somebody. Identify who that somebody is and do all you possibly can do for their benefit. And you'll then find out what it means to be successful. Now, secondly, view your job as a gift from God. MSNBC reports that up to 87% of people in America do not like their jobs. You've heard all the reasons why. We're overworked, we're underpaid, we're too often unappreciated. Paul recommended a different approach in Colossians 3:23. He says, work hard and cheerfully at whatever you do, as though you were working for the Lord rather than for people. Here's what I suggest. Instead of dreaming of greener pastures, Try approaching the job with an attitude of contentment and an attitude of devotion. Maybe your boss is clueless. You know, maybe you're not being paid what you're worth. Who among us is? You know? Maybe your efforts go unnoticed by the powers that be. Many of us are there. But remember this, it is God the Father for whom you really work. He's your real boss. He notices things that your earthly boss may never see. He notices when you show up a little early, when you give 110%, when you sacrifice free time to get a project finished, when you work with a headache, when you're unfairly criticized, when you don't get the recognition you deserve. He sees all these things. And Jesus says, your Father who knows all secrets will reward you in Matthew 6:18. So remember who you work for. A third thing here is do your job with your eyes on eternity. Do your job with your eyes on eternity. The fact is that there are many aspects of our jobs that are frustratingly temporal. You know, straightening a bookshelf or collar coordinating the neckties won't change the world. Sometimes it's hard to get excited about the mundane details. It's like this in every job, so you can't allow yourself to focus on those matters. Instead, look at the aspects of your job that will last. Look at how you can impact people's lives over the long term. Paul said all athletes practice self-control. They do it to win a prize that will fade away. But we do it for an eternal prize. 1 Corinthians 9:25. There are aspects of your job that will live on and on. Identify those aspects and do everything that you can to maximize them. Now here's the example of one woman who did that. It's a story about a teacher named Mrs. Thompson. As Mrs. Thompson stood in front of her fifth grade class on the very first day of school, she told the children a lie. Like most teachers, she looked at the students and said that she loved them all the same. But that was impossible because there in the front row, slumped in his seat, was a little boy named Teddy Stallard. Mrs. Thompson had watched Teddy the year before and noticed that he didn't play well with the other children. His clothes were messy and he was in a constant need of a bath. Teddy could be unpleasant. It got to the point where Mrs. Thompson would actually take delight in marking his papers with a broad red pen, marking bold X's and then putting a big F at the top of the papers. At the school where Mrs. Thompson taught, she was required to review H. child's past records, and she put Teddy's off until the last. However, when she reviewed his file, she was in for a surprise. Teddy's first grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is a bright child with a ready laugh. He does his work neatly and has good manners. He's a joy to be around." His second grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is an excellent student, well liked by his classmates, but he is troubled because his mother has a terminal illness and life at home must be a struggle." His third grade teacher wrote, "His mother's death has been very hard on him. He tries to do his best, but his father doesn't show much interest in his home life. Will soon affect him if some steps aren't taken." Teddy's fourth grade teacher wrote, "Teddy is withdrawn. He doesn't show much interest in school. He doesn't have many friends, and sometimes he sleeps in class." By now, Mrs. Thompson realized the problem, and she was ashamed of herself. She felt even worse when her students brought their Christmas presents, wrapped in beautiful ribbons and bright paper, except for Teddy's. His present was clumsily wrapped in the heavy brown paper that he got from a grocery bag. And Mrs. Thompson took pains to open it in the middle of the other presents. Some of the children started to laugh when she found a rhinestone bracelet with some of the stones missing, and a bottle that was only a quarter full of perfume. But she stifled the children's laughter when she exclaimed how pretty the bracelet was, and putting it on, and then she dabbed some of the perfume on her wrist. Teddy Stallard stayed after school that day just long enough to say, "Mrs. Thompson, today you smell just like my mom." And after the children left, she cried for at least an hour. On that very day, she quit teaching reading and writing and arithmetic. Instead, she began to teach children. And Mrs. Thompson paid particularly close attention to Teddy. And as she worked with him, his mind seemed to come alive. And the more she encouraged him, the faster he responded. And by the end of the year, Teddy had become one of the smartest children in the class. And despite her lie that she would love all the children the same, Teddy became one of the teacher's pets. A year later, she found a note under her door from Teddy telling her that she was still the best teacher that he had ever had in his whole life. 6 years went by before she got another note from Teddy. He then wrote that he had finished high school, third in his class, and she was still the best teacher he had ever had in his whole life. 4 years after that, she got another letter saying that while things had been tough at times, he stayed in school and he stuck it out and would soon graduate from college with the highest of honors. He assured Miss Thompson that she was still the best and favorite teacher he ever had in his whole life. Then 4 more years passed and yet another letter came. This time he explained that after he got his bachelor's degree, he decided to go a little further. And the letter explained that she was still the best and favorite teacher he ever had. But now his name was a little longer. The letter was signed Theodore F. Stallard, M.D. The story doesn't end there. You see, there was yet another letter that spring. Teddy said he had met this girl and he was going to be married. He explained that his father had died a couple of years ago and he was wondering if Mrs. Thompson might agree to sit in their place at the wedding. And of course, Mrs. Thompson did. And guess what? She wore that bracelet, the one with several rhinestones missing. And she made sure she was wearing the perfume that Teddy remembered his mother wearing on the last Christmas together. They hugged each other. And Dr. Stallard whispered in Mrs. Thompson's ear, "Thank you, Mrs. Thompson, for believing in me. Thank you so much for making me feel important and showing me that I could make a difference." Mrs. Thompson, with tears in her eyes, whispered back and said, "Teddy, you have it all wrong. You were the one who taught me that I could make a difference. I didn't know how to teach until I met you." The story teaches us the difference we can make in the lives of others. No matter what your job is, no matter what your career may be, you have a mission. It is your mission that defines you. It's not your bank account or your success at the office. Your mission involves serving others for the glory of God. That's what success is. Success is choosing to enter the arena of action, determined to give yourself to the cause that will better humanity and last for eternity. This feature is built into almost every job. You just have to find it. It could be as simple as this. Stop defining yourself by your job title. Start defining yourself by your job description. It's not a matter of what others call you. It's a question of how God has called you for the sake of others. This is what it means to live with a mission. And this is what it means to experience true success.